Well, I was in New York, and I was in a kitchen appliance store, and there you go. I mean, like you are, you know. And it had a kitchen window display in the window, and then there'd be a row of microwaves or, you know, cookers and things like that. And then at the back of the store was a big wall of televisions, all tuned to MTV. And there was some bonehead who worked for the store, a great big macho guy with a check shirt on and a cap and a pair of work boots, and he'd been delivering stuff at the back, and he was watching MTV. And he was saying all these great lines about, you know, that ain't working, you know, that's the way you do it, and stuff like that. And what's that Hawaiian noises he was saying? And so I just thought it was so classic that I went and asked for a pen and paper and started writing the lines down, you know. Right, yes. And then when I started putting it to music, again, that old finger and thumb thing, it's sort of a double, you know.
Hi, this is Mark Donner. Welcome to the Rock and Roll Content Show, Episode 2. That interview was from a 2000 BBC interview with Mark Knopfler, guitarist and songwriter and singer from the band Dire Straits, talking about the hit song Money for Nothing. More on that shortly. Making content can be tricky. You might have a really great idea and know what story you want to tell. You might use lessons learned from last week's episode, taking inspiration from David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust in order to simplify your story and let your audience bring their own ideas and narratives to it. But once you've done that, where do you put it? How do you share it so that it reaches the right people and gets to the right places? There was once a moment on the internet a decade or so ago where it was almost enough to create something on your website, a blog post for instance, and share that link out on your social media. Over time, though, things changed. Social media platforms got busier. More people started making content, sharing content. The social media platforms monetized, added new revenue streams. The likelihood of the audience you build on those platforms actually seeing the content you shared? Let's just say that it wasn't very high. We're at a point now where every channel that you utilize for your content needs to be looked at least to some degree independently. Your story could be the same, but the way you tell it may really change in order to reach the right audience. That's where multi-channel content and content repurposing come into play. If you're not familiar with them, here's a quick overview. Multi-channel content means what it says, simply distributing and promoting content via more than one channel. Channels might mean your blog, different social media accounts like Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, even your podcast. Content repurposing then kind of means what it sounds like as well, just taking existing content and making use of it in more than one way or on more than one channel. If you're following along, that would be how it connects to multi-channel content. So how do you take that story you want to tell and make sure that it resonates on the channels that you want to use? For a little illustration, let's get into our music topic and go back in time to the 1980s. If you remember that era, join me in the nostalgia. If you're too young for that, just take our word for it, I guess. Let's talk MTV. Not the weird reality show network that it eventually became, but the cable TV channel that it began as, playing music videos nearly 24/7. MTV was released on the 1st of August 1981 in the United States, eventually spreading throughout the world. It was basically a radio station, complete with DJs, known as VJs, and a lot of other trappings that you might find on FM rock and pop radio at the time. The twist? You can watch it. Most early music videos were simple live performances or live in-studio videos, artist promos done by record labels, a lot of repurposed stuff. MTV kind of took what it could get initially, But something happened fairly quickly. Over a short period of time, the network started to move the needle for artists in a way that hadn't happened before. And a new crop of artists focused more on visual imagery and good looks and style started to appear. The bands of the 1970s who weren't interested, didn't play along with this new visual medium, or were simply a little too old or not attractive enough to make a good showing on MTV, they faded into the background. For artists who were right for it, who embraced it, and who started to make content with videos in mind, MTV became a significant driver for promotion, distribution, and record sales. Dire Straits was one such band. They started in 1977 and had a full 4 years together as a band with three great albums under their belt before MTV even hit the airwaves. Singer and guitarist Mark Knopfler was not a fan of MTV or music videos in general. Sure, Dire Straits released videos throughout the years. You had to at that point. But most really didn't get the attention that they could have. Then came 1985. MTV was like 3 or 4 years old at this point, and honestly, it gotten a little stagnant by the time Dire Straits began work on their Brothers in Arms album. Some artists were still doing the bare minimum and releasing performance videos on a concert stage or in a studio. Some artists had gotten really creative, using film directors and actors, the latest visual effects, and even compelling storylines to create something entirely new out of their latest singles. A new industry had been built up around the new medium known as the music video. According to the 2012 book, I Want My MTV, The Uncensored Story of the Music Video by Rob Tannenbaum, Dire Straits management went to MTV asking point blank, what could we do to get on the network? Their response? Essentially, it was to make a hit song with MTV in mind. An MTV-able song, as they put it. And of course, that would include a great music video. Easy, right? Well, not as easy in 1985 as it would be today. Despite his misgivings, Knopfler took that to heart in his own special way. He wasn't really a fan of music videos or MTV, but after nudging from his girlfriend and others, he wrote a cynical song told from the point of view of a couple of appliance movers that he'd overheard talking about MTV and how easy those rock stars' lives must be compared to theirs. The song featured their friend, Sting, who lent his voice to the beginning of the song, singing the words, I'm not going to sing them, just going to say them, I want my MTV. Literally, an MTV-able song. The song, Money for Nothing, was a bit condescending towards the network, but they loved it. They loved having their name in it. Though it was condescending and sarcastic in a way that only Mark Knopfler could deliver, the phrase, I want my MTV, was simple, memorable. Remember last week when we talked about Bowie and Ziggy Stardust, the simplicity of that, and how fans brought their own narratives to the story? That's what happened here. Dire Straits produced a video using one of the great video directors of the 1980s, Steve Barron, who also had made the videos for A-ha's Take on Me, Thomas Dolby's She Blinded Me with Science, among a lot of others. And the video featured digitally animated characters, those two aforementioned appliance movers, now shaped like TVs, with other TVs showing the MTV logo and playing other music videos. Kind of meta and pretty innovative for the time. The video became a massive hit for Dire Straits and MTV. I Want My MTV became the slogan for the network for years to come. Let's take Money for Nothing as an example here because I'm a big Dire Straits fan. I love the band. Mark Knopfler is one of my favorite guitar players. I could probably list 20 or so of my favorite Dire Straits songs before I got to Money for Nothing. It's a good song, a catchy song, but they have so many amazingly crafted songs that Money for Nothing is fairly pedestrian by comparison. But when you combine that with that cool 8-bit imagery and inject it into the pop culture zeitgeist that was 1985 MTV, it elevates Money for Nothing into the first song people think of when they think about Dire Straits. I Want My MTV became a slogan that the whole world knows. Every teenager had it on their lips during the mid to late 80s. MTV-able, for sure. And that's kind of what multi-channel content is. How do we take our content and make it MTV-able, the way Dire Straits did for MTV, this new platform? Well, what did Mark Knopfler do? First of all, according to the recounting anyway, he took MTV executives literally by making a song about music videos. He did it in a real jackass sort of way. We might take a more positive approach. But then he worked with his team to create visual elements that were undeniable. Once paired with that good song, it all took off. Whatever MTVable means to you or your audience, that's what you should look for. Take it literally. Create content that literally addresses a need of your audience, whatever that might be. And your audiences, this is the thing about multi-channel content, your audience, your personas, another term that we talk about quite a bit, they might change depending on what channel you're on. If you do have multiple personas or customer segments, you might aim different content at different channels based on the personas that are most likely to visit those channels. Multi-channel content not only allows you to reach a wider audience or different audiences, as we just talked about, it increases the likelihood that your content gets seen by your intended audience. If done well, multi-channel content has the ability to become more than the sum of its parts. But it's more than just taking your content on one channel and putting it on another, as we've talked about. You've got to kind of re-engineer that content. Make it work natively for the new channel so that it can stand alone if it needs to. How do we take these ideas from theory and put them into practice? Here's a few tips. So where is your audience? Your persona should not only outline who your target audience member is, but where they're at online. What platforms do they frequently engage with? If you're looking to add a channel, that's probably where you should start. What are others doing? I don't mean your competitors or other content creators in your area. What are people or brands in completely different spaces doing? For a practical example of multi-channel content and content repurposing in action, let's leave rock and roll for just a moment and move to the realm of stand-up comedy. I recently saw comedian Sam Morril at a local comedy club. Sam is one of a number of comics who are doing some really interesting things with multi-channel content in the comedy space. His core content channel would probably be live performance. Once that core act is honed and fine-tuned, he might release a comedy special that's distributed on a streaming platform like YouTube or Netflix. Most of the bits that go into those specials are evergreen content that will be funny to most audiences and will kind of stand the test of time, devoid of local references and in-the-moment occurrences for the most part. If you've ever seen a great comic, you know there's a lot of crowd work that goes on in a live show. Things that happen in the moment. Jokes that are local in nature or that reflect something that's happened in the news. Or perhaps a heckler that says something that makes a comedian really think on their feet and do something that's really funny and memorable. Sam keeps a camera on all of those weekly performances, and during the week he clips those out for promotional content on Instagram and other social media channels. The evergreen content that he's honing to go into his specials stay protected. Those in-the-moment bits become the fuel that drive his overall content strategy. Finally, he's got podcasts, including his primary one with friend and comedian Mark Norman called We Might Be Drunk, and a new sports podcast with retired Patriots wide receiver Julian Edelman. Both of those channels are mostly unrelated to his live show, though he does introduce and workshop new ideas with Norman from time to time on the podcast. They serve as a vehicle for promoting his primary content channel, which is, of course, his live performances and his specials. I don't know if comics like Morril have ever thought of this as a multi-channel content strategy, and I don't know if he does this purely by himself or if he's got a support team that does it for him. But it's a pretty good example of content differentiation, multi-channel content, and content repurposing. Think about the kinds of content that you create and how they might work together like this. What evergreen content should you be kind of holding and protecting, saving for your core content, your flagship content? What in-the-moment content can you use as a promotional vehicle? I think it's a pretty smart strategy. Influence can come from so many different sources, and it's a huge part of creativity. As we close, let's think about Dire Straits again. What are you going to do to make your content MTVable? How are you going to change your strategy, differentiate your content on your different channels to resonate with your audience wherever they are? Tell me. podcast@rockcontent.show is the email address if you got suggestions or ideas. Thanks for listening. We've got another episode coming next week. I'm working on it now, and since we're getting a little closer to Halloween, might be a little scary. Until then, though, this is Mark Donner from the Rock and Roll Content Show, and if you'll excuse me, I've got to move those microwave ovens.